Both Nietzsche and Machiavelli have an ethic which aims at power and is deliberately anti-Christian, though Nietzsche is more frank in this respect. What Caesar Borgia was to Machiavelli, Napoleon was to Nietzsche, a great man defeated by petty opponents. Nietzsche's criticism of religions and philosophies is dominated entirely by ethical motives. He admires certain qualities which he believes, perhaps rightly, to be only possible for an aristocratic minority. The majority, in his opinion, should be only means to the excellence of the few, and should not be regarded as having any independent claim to happiness or well-being. He alludes habitually to ordinary human beings as the bungled and botched, and sees no objection to their suffering if it is necessary for the production of a great man. Thus, the whole importance of the period from 1789 to 1815 is summed up in Napoleon. The revolution made Napoleon possible. That is its justification. We ought to desire the anarchical collapse of the whole of our civilization if such a reward were to be its result. Napoleon made nationalism possible. That is the latter's excuse. Almost all of the higher hopes of this century, he says, are due to Napoleon. He is fond of expressing himself paradoxically and with a view to shocking conventional readers. He does this by employing the words good and evil with their ordinary connotations and then saying that he prefers evil to good. His book, Beyond Good and Evil, really aims at changing the reader's opinion as to what is good and what is evil, but professes, except at moments, to be praising what is evil and decrying what is good. He says, for instance, that it is a mistake to regard it as a duty to aim at the victory of good and the annihilation of evil. This view is English, and typical of that blockhead John Stuart Mill, a man for whom he has a specially virulent contempt. Of him he says, "I abhor the man's vulgarity when he says, what is right for one man is right for another. Do not to others that which you would not that they should do unto you." Footnote. I seem to remember that someone anticipated Mill in this dictum. End of footnote. Such principles would fain establish the whole of human traffic upon mutual services, so that every action would appear to be a cash payment for something done to us. The hypothesis here is ignoble to the last degree. It is taken for granted that there is some sort of equivalence in value between my actions and thine. True virtue, as opposed to the conventional sort, is not for all, but should remain the characteristic of an aristocratic minority. It is not profitable or prudent. It isolates its possessor from other men. It is hostile to order and does harm to inferiors. It is necessary for higher men to make war upon the masses and resist the democratic tendencies of the age. For in all directions, mediocre people are joining hands to make themselves masters. Everything that pampers, that softens, and that brings the people or woman to the front operates in favor of universal suffrage, that is to say, the dominion of inferior men. The seducer was Rousseau, who made woman interesting. Then came Harriet Beecher Stowe and the slaves, then the socialists with their championship of workmen and the poor. All these are to be combated. Nietzsche's ethic is not one of self-indulgence in any ordinary sense. He believes in Spartan discipline and the capacity to endure as well as inflict pain for important ends. He admires strength of will above all things. "I test the power of a will," he says, "according to the amount of resistance it can offer and the amount of pain and torture it can endure and know how to turn to its own advantage. I do not point to the evil and pain of existence with the finger of reproach, but rather entertain the hope that life may one day become more evil and more full of suffering than it has ever been." He regards compassion as a weakness to be combated. The object is to attain that enormous energy of greatness which can model the man of the future by means of discipline, and also by means of the annihilation of millions of the bungled and botched, and which can yet avoid going to ruin at the sight of the suffering created thereby, the like of which has never been seen before. He prophesied with a certain glee an era of great wars. One wonders whether he would have been happy if he had lived to see the fulfillment of his prophecy. He is not, however, a worshipper of the state. Far from it. He is a passionate individualist, a believer in the hero. The misery of a whole nation, he says, is of less importance than the suffering of a great individual. The misfortunes of all these small folk do not together constitute a sum total, except in the feelings of mighty men. Nietzsche is not a nationalist, and shows no excessive admiration for Germany. He wants an international ruling race, who are to be the lords of the earth. A new vast aristocracy, based upon the most severe self-discipline, in which the will of philosophical men of power and artist tyrants will be stamped upon thousands of years. He is also not definitely anti-Semitic, though he thinks Germany contains as many Jews as it can assimilate and ought not to permit any further influx of Jews. He dislikes the New Testament, but not the Old, of which he speaks in terms of the highest admiration. In justice to Nietzsche, it must be emphasized that many modern developments which have a certain connection with his general ethical outlook are contrary to his clearly expressed opinions. Two applications of his ethic deserve notice. First, his contempt for women. Second, his bitter critique of Christianity. He has never tired of inveighing against women. In his pseudo-prophetical book, Thus Spake Zarathustra, he says that women are not as yet capable of friendship. They are still cats, or birds, or at best cows. Man shall be trained for war, and woman for the recreation of the warrior. All else is folly. The recreation of the warrior is to be of a peculiar sort, if one may trust his most emphatic aphorism on this subject. Thou goest to woman, do not forget thy whip. He is not always quite so fierce, though always equally contemptuous. In The Will to Power, he says, we take pleasure in woman as in a perhaps daintier, more delicate, and more ethereal kind of creature. What a treat it is to meet creatures who have only dancing and nonsense and finery in their minds. They have always been the delight of every tense and profound male soul. However, even these graces are only to be found in women so long as they are kept in order by manly men. As soon as they achieve any independence, they become intolerable. Woman has so much cause for shame. In woman there is so much pedantry, superficiality, schoolmasterliness, petty presumption, unbridledness, and indiscretion concealed, which has really been best restrained and dominated hitherto by the fear of man. So he says in Beyond Good and Evil, where he adds that we should think of woman as property, as Orientals do. The whole of his abuse of women is offered as self-evident truth. It is not backed up by evidence from history or from his own experience, which, so far as women were concerned, was almost confined to his sister. Nietzsche's objection to Christianity is that it caused acceptance of what he calls slave morality. It is curious to observe the contrast between his arguments and those of the French philosophes who preceded the revolution. They argued that Christian dogmas are untrue, that Christianity teaches submission to what is deemed to be the will of God, whereas self-respecting human beings should not bow before any higher power, and that the Christian churches have become the allies of tyrants, and are helping the enemies of democracy to deny liberty and continue to grind the faces of the poor. Nietzsche is not interested in the metaphysical truth of either Christianity or any other religion. Being convinced that no religion is really true, he judges all religions entirely by their social effects. He agrees with the philosophe in objecting to submission to the supposed will of God, but he would substitute for it the will of earthly artist tyrants. Submission is right, except for these supermen, but not submission to the Christian God. As for the Christian churches being allies of tyrants and enemies of democracy, that, he says, is the very reverse of the truth. The French Revolution and socialism are, according to him, essentially identical in spirit with Christianity. To all alike he is opposed, and for the same reason, that he will not treat all men as equal in any respect whatever. Buddhism and Christianity, he says, are both nihilistic religions, in the sense that they deny any ultimate difference of value between one man and another. But Buddhism is much the less objectionable of the two. Christianity is degenerative, full of decaying and excremental elements. Its driving force is the revolt of the bungled and botched. This revolt was begun by the Jews, and brought into Christianity by holy epileptics like St. Paul, who had no honesty. The New Testament is the gospel of a completely ignoble species of man. Christianity is the most fatal and seductive lie that ever existed. No man of note has ever resembled the Christian ideal. Consider, for instance, the heroes of Plutarch's Lives. Christianity is to be condemned for denying the value of pride, pathos of distance, great responsibility, exuberant spirits, splendid animalism, the instincts of war and of conquest, the deification of passion, revenge, anger, voluptuousness, adventure, knowledge. All these things are good, and all are said by Christianity to be bad, so Nietzsche contends. Christianity, he argues, aims at taming the heart in man, but this is a mistake. A wild beast has a certain splendor, which it loses when it is tamed. The criminals with whom Dostoevsky associated were better than he was because they were more self-respecting. Nietzsche is nauseated by repentance and redemption, which he calls a folie séculaire. It is difficult for us to free ourselves from this way of thinking about human behavior. We are heirs to the conscience vivisection and self-crucifixion of 2,000 years. There is a very eloquent passage about Pascal which deserves quotation because it shows Nietzsche's objections to Christianity at their best. What is it that we combat in Christianity? That it aims at destroying the strong, at breaking their spirit, at exploiting their moments of weariness and debility, at converting their proud assurance into anxiety and conscience trouble. That it knows how to poison the noblest instincts and to infect them with disease until their strength, their will to power, turns inwards, against themselves, until the strong perish through their excessive self-contempt and self-immolation. That gruesome way of perishing of which Pascal is the most famous example. In place of the Christian saint, Nietzsche wishes to see what he calls the noble man, by no means as a universal type, but as a governing aristocrat. The noble man will be capable of cruelty, and on occasion of what is vulgarly regarded as crime. He will recognize duties only to equals. He will protect artists and poets, and all who happen to be masters of some skill. But he will do so as himself a member of a higher order than those who only know how to do something. From the example of warriors, he will learn to associate death with the interests for which he is fighting, to sacrifice numbers and take his cause sufficiently seriously not to spare men, to practice inexorable discipline, and to allow himself violence and cunning in war. He will recognize the part played by cruelty in aristocratic excellence. Almost everything that we call higher culture is based upon the spiritualizing and intensifying of cruelty. The nobleman is essentially the incarnate will to power. What are we to think of Nietzsche's doctrines? How far are they true? Are they in any degree useful? Is there in them anything objective, or are they the mere power fantasies of an invalid? It is undeniable that Nietzsche has had a great influence, not among technical philosophers, but among people of literary and artistic culture. It must also be conceded that his prophecies as to the future have so far proved more nearly right than those of liberals or socialists. If he is a mere symptom of disease, the disease must be very widespread in the modern world. Nevertheless, there is a great deal in him that must be dismissed as merely megalomaniac. Speaking of Spinoza, he says, "How much of personal timidity and vulnerability does this masquerade of a sickly recluse betray?" Exactly the same may be said of him, with less reluctance, since he has not hesitated to say it of Spinoza. It is obvious that in his daydreams he is a warrior, not a professor. All the men he admires were military. His opinion of women, like every man's, is an objectification of his own emotion towards them, which is obviously one of fear. Forget not thy whip, but 9 women out of 10 would get the whip away from him, and he knew it, so he kept away from women and soothed his wounded vanity with unkind remarks. He condemns Christian love because he thinks it is an outcome of fear. I am afraid my neighbor may injure me, and so I assure him that I love him. If I were stronger and bolder, I should openly display the contempt for him which of course I feel. It does not occur to Nietzsche as possible that a man should genuinely feel universal love, obviously because he himself feels almost universal hatred and fear. which he would fain disguise as lordly indifference. His nobleman, who is himself in daydreams, is a being wholly devoid of sympathy, ruthless, cunning, cruel, concerned only with his own power. King Lear, on the verge of madness, says, "I will do such things, what they are yet I know not, but they shall be the terror of the earth." This is Nietzsche's philosophy in a nutshell. It never occurred to Nietzsche that the lust for power, with which he endows his Superman, is itself an outcome of fear. Those who do not fear their neighbors see no necessity to tyrannize over them. Men who have conquered fear have not the frantic quality of Nietzsche's artist-tyrant Neros, who try to enjoy music and massacre while their hearts are filled with dread of the inevitable palace revolution. I will not deny that, partly as a result of his teaching, the real world has become very like his nightmare, but that does not make it any the less horrible. It must be admitted that there is a certain type of Christian ethic to which Nietzsche's strictures can be justly applied. Pascal and Dostoevsky, his own illustrations, have both something abject in their virtue. Pascal sacrificed his magnificent mathematical intellect to his God, thereby attributing to him a barbarity which was a cosmic enlargement of Pascal's morbid mental tortures. Dostoevsky would have nothing to do with proper pride. He would sin in order to repent and to enjoy the luxury of confession. I will not argue the question how far such aberrations can justly be charged against Christianity, but I will admit that I agree with Nietzsche in thinking Dostoevsky's prostration contemptible. A certain uprightness and pride, and even self-assertion of a sort, I should agree, are elements in the best character. No virtue which has its roots in fear is much to be admired. There are two sorts of saints, the saint by nature and the saint from fear. The saint by nature has a spontaneous love of mankind. He does good because to do so gives him happiness. The saint from fear, on the other hand, like the man who only abstains from theft because of the police, would be wicked if he were not restrained by the thought of hellfire or of his neighbor's vengeance. Nietzsche can only imagine the second sort of saint. He is so full of fear and hatred that spontaneous love of mankind seems to him impossible. He has never conceived of the man who, with all the fearlessness and stubborn pride of the Superman, nevertheless does not inflict pain because he has no wish to do so. Does anyone suppose that Lincoln acted as he did from fear of hell? Yet to Nietzsche, Lincoln is abject, Napoleon magnificent. It remains to consider the main ethical problem raised by Nietzsche, namely, should our ethic be aristocratic, or should it, in some sense, treat all men alike? This is a question which, as I have just stated it, has no very clear meaning, and obviously the first step is to try to make the issue more definite. We must, in the first place, try to distinguish an aristocratic ethic from an aristocratic political theory. A believer in Bentham's principle of the greatest happiness of the greatest number has a democratic ethic, but he may think that the general happiness is best promoted by an aristocratic form of government. This is not Nietzsche's position. He holds that the happiness of common people is no part of the good per se. All that is good or bad in itself exists only in the superior few. What happens to the rest is of no account. The next question is, how are the superior few defined? In practice, they have usually been a conquering race or a hereditary aristocracy, and aristocracies have usually been, at least in theory, descendants of conquering races. I think Nietzsche would accept this definition. No morality is possible without good birth, he tells us. He says that the noble caste is always at first barbarian, but that every elevation of man is due to aristocratic society. It is not clear whether Nietzsche regards the superiority of the aristocrat as congenital or as due to education and environment. If the latter, it is difficult to defend the exclusion of others from advantages for which, ex hypothesi, they are equally qualified. I shall therefore assume that he regards conquering aristocracies and their descendants as biologically superior to their subjects, as men are superior to domestic animals, though in a lesser degree. What shall we mean by biologically superior? We shall mean, when interpreting Nietzsche, that individuals of the superior race and their descendants are more likely to be noble in Nietzsche's sense. They will have more strength of will, more courage, more impulse towards power, less sympathy, less fear, and less gentleness. We can now state Nietzsche's ethic. I think what follows is a fair analysis of it. Victors in war and their descendants are usually biologically superior to the vanquished. It is therefore desirable that they should hold all the power and should manage affairs exclusively in their own interests. There is here still the word desirable to be considered. What is desirable in Nietzsche's philosophy? From the outsider's point of view, what Nietzsche calls desirable is what Nietzsche desires. With this interpretation, Nietzsche's doctrine might be stated more simply and honestly in the one sentence. I wish I had lived in the Athens of Pericles or the Florence of the Medici. But this is not a philosophy. It is a biographical fact about a certain individual. The word desirable is not synonymous with desired by me. It has some claim, however shadowy, to legislative universality. A theist may say that what is desirable is what God desires, but Nietzsche cannot say this. He could say that he knows what is good by an ethical intuition, but he will not say this because it sounds too Kantian. What he can say, as an expansion of the word desirable, is this. If men will read my works, a certain percentage of them will come to share my desires as regards the organization of society. These men, inspired by the energy and determination which my philosophy will give them, can preserve and restore aristocracy, with themselves as aristocrats or, like me, sycophants of aristocracy. In this way, they will achieve a fuller life than they can have as servants of the people. There is another element in Nietzsche which is closely akin to the objection urged by rugged individualists against trade unions. In a fight of all against all, the victor is likely to possess certain qualities which Nietzsche admires, such as courage, resourcefulness, and strength of will. But if the men who do not possess these aristocratic qualities, who are the vast majority, band themselves together, they may win in spite of their individual inferiority. In this fight of the collective canaille against the aristocrats, Christianity is the ideological front, as the French Revolution was the fighting front. We ought therefore to oppose every kind of union among the individually feeble, for fear lest their combined power should outweigh that of the individually strong. On the other hand, we ought to promote union among the tough and virile elements of the population. The first step towards the creation of such a union is the preaching of Nietzsche's philosophy. It will be seen that it is not easy to preserve the distinction between ethics and politics. Suppose we wish, as I certainly do, to find arguments against Nietzsche's ethics and politics. What arguments can we find? There are weighty practical arguments, showing that the attempt to secure his ends will in fact secure something quite different. Aristocracies of birth are nowadays discredited. The only practicable form of aristocracy is an organization like the fascist or the Nazi party. Such an organization rouses opposition and is likely to be defeated in war, but if it is not defeated, it must before long become nothing but a police state, where the rulers live in terror of assassination and the heroes are in concentration camps. In such a community, faith and honor are sapped by delation, and the would-be aristocracy of supermen degenerates into a clique of trembling poltroons. These, however, are arguments for our time. They would not have held good in past ages when aristocracy was unquestioned. The Egyptian government was conducted on Nietzschean principles for several millennia. The governments of almost all large states were aristocratic until the American and the French revolutions. We have therefore to ask ourselves whether there is any good reason for preferring democracy to a form of government which has had such a long and successful history. Or rather, since we are concerned with philosophy, not politics, whether there are objective grounds for rejecting the ethic by which Nietzsche supports aristocracy. The ethical, as opposed to the political question, is one as to sympathy. Sympathy, in the sense of being made unhappy by the sufferings of others, is to some extent natural to human beings. Young children are troubled when they hear other children crying. But the development of this feeling is very different in different people. Some find pleasure in the infliction of torture. Others, like Buddha, feel that they cannot be completely happy so long as any living thing is suffering. Most people divide mankind emotionally into friends and enemies, feeling sympathy for the former but not for the latter. An ethic such as that of Christianity or Buddhism has its emotional basis in universal sympathy. Nietzsche's in a complete absence of sympathy. He frequently preaches against sympathy, and in this respect one feels that he has no difficulty in obeying his own precepts. The question is, if Buddha and Nietzsche were confronted, could either produce any argument that ought to appeal to the impartial listener? I am not thinking of political arguments. We can imagine them appearing before the Almighty, as in the first chapter of the book of Job, and offering advice as to the sort of world he should create. What could either say? Buddha would open the argument by speaking of the lepers, outcast and miserable, the poor toiling with aching limbs and barely kept alive by scanty nourishment, the wounded in battle, dying in slow agony, the orphans ill-treated by cruel guardians, and even the most successful haunted by the thought of failure and death. From all this load of sorrow, he would say, a way of salvation must be found, and salvation can only come through love. Nietzsche, whom only omnipotence could restrain from interrupting, would burst out when his turn came. Good heavens, man, you must learn to be of tougher fibre. Why go about snivelling because trivial people suffer? Or, for that matter, because great men suffer? Trivial people suffer trivially, great men suffer greatly, and great sufferings are not to be regretted because they are noble. Your ideal is a purely negative one, absence of suffering, which can be completely secured by non-existence. I, on the other hand, have positive ideals. I admire Alcibiades and the Emperor Frederick II and Napoleon. For the sake of such men, any misery is worthwhile. I appeal to you, Lord, as the greatest of creative artists, do not let your artistic impulses be curbed by the degenerate, fear-ridden maunderings of this wretched psychopath. Buddha, who in the courts of heaven has learnt all history since his death, and has mastered science with delight in the knowledge and sorrow at the use to which men have put it, replies with calm urbanity. You are mistaken, Professor Nietzsche, in thinking my ideal a purely negative one. True, it includes a negative element, the absence of suffering, but it has in addition quite as much that is positive as is to be found in your doctrine. Though I have no special admiration for Alcibiades and Napoleon, I too have my heroes. My successor Jesus, because he told men to love their enemies. The men who discovered how to master the forces of nature and secure food with less labor. The medical men who have shown how to diminish disease. The poets and artists and musicians who have caught glimpses of the divine beatitude. Love and knowledge and delight in beauty are not negations. They are enough to fill the lives of the greatest men that have ever lived. All the same, Nietzsche replies, your world would be insipid. You should study Heraclitus, whose works survive complete in the celestial library. Your love is compassion, which is elicited by pain. Your truth, if you are honest, is unpleasant and only to be known through suffering. And as to beauty, what is more beautiful than the tiger who owes his splendor to his fierceness? No, if the Lord should decide for your world, I fear we should all die of boredom. You might, Buddha replies, because you love pain, and your love of life is a sham. But those who really love life would be happy as no one can be happy in the world as it is. For my part, I agree with Buddha as I have imagined him. But I do not know how to prove that he is right by any argument such as can be used in a mathematical or a scientific question. I dislike Nietzsche because he likes the contemplation of pain, because he erects conceit into a duty, because the men whom he most admires are conquerors whose glory is cleverness in causing men to die. But I think the ultimate argument against his philosophy, as against any unpleasant but internally self-consistent ethic, lies not in an appeal to facts, but in an appeal to the emotions. Nietzsche despises universal love. I feel it the motive power to all that I desire as regards the world. His followers have had their innings, but we may hope that it is coming rapidly to an end. Chapter 26. The Utilitarians. Throughout the period from Kant to Nietzsche, professional philosophers in Great Britain remained almost completely unaffected by their German contemporaries, with the sole exception of Sir William Hamilton, who had little influence. Coleridge and Carlyle, it is true, were profoundly affected by Kant, Fichte, and the German Romantics, but they were not philosophers in the technical sense. Somebody seems to have once mentioned Kant to James Mill, who, after a cursory inspection, remarked, "I see well enough what poor Kant would be at." But this degree of recognition is exceptional. In general, there is a complete silence about the Germans. Bentham and his school derived their philosophy, in all its main outlines, from Locke, Hartley, and Helvetius. Their importance is not so much philosophical as political, as the leaders of British radicalism, and as the men who unintentionally prepared the way for the doctrines of socialism. Jeremy Bentham, who was the recognized head of the philosophical radicals, was not the sort of man one expects to find at the head of a movement of this sort. He was born in 1748, but did not become a radical till 1808. He was painfully shy, and could not, without great trepidation, endure the company of strangers. He wrote voluminously, but never bothered to publish. What was published under his name had been benevolently purloined by his friends. His main interest was jurisprudence, in which he recognized Helvetius and Baccaria as his most important predecessors. It was through the theory of law that he became interested in ethics and politics. He bases his whole philosophy on two principles, the association principle and the greatest happiness principle. The association principle had been emphasized by Hartley in 1749. Before him, though association of ideas was recognized as occurring, it was regarded, for instance, by Locke, only as a source of trivial errors. Bentham, following Hartley, made it the basic principle of psychology. He recognizes association of ideas and language, and also association of ideas and ideas. By means of this principle, he aims at a deterministic account of mental occurrences. In essence, the doctrine is the same as the more modern theory of the conditioned reflex, based on Pavlov's experiments. The only important difference is that Pavlov's conditioned reflex is physiological, whereas the association of ideas was purely mental. Pavlov's work is therefore capable of a materialistic explanation, such as is given to it by the behaviorists, whereas the association of ideas led rather towards a psychology more or less independent of physiology. There can be no doubt that, scientifically, the principle of the conditioned reflex is an advance on the older principle. Pavlov's principle is this. Given a reflex according to which a stimulus B produces a reaction C, and given that a certain animal has frequently experienced a stimulus A at the same time as B, it often happens that in time the stimulus A will produce the reaction C even when B is absent. To determine the circumstances under which this happens is a matter of experiment. Clearly, if we substitute ideas for A, B, and C, Pavlov's principle becomes that of the association of ideas. Both principles, indubitably, are valid over a certain field. The only controversial question is as to the extent of this field. Bentham and his followers exaggerated the extent of the field in the case of Hartley's principle, as certain behaviorists have in the case of Pavlov's principle. To Bentham, determinism in psychology was important, because he wished to establish a code of laws, and, more generally, a social system which would automatically make men virtuous. His second principle, that of the greatest happiness, became necessary at this point in order to define virtue. Bentham maintained that what is good is pleasure or happiness. He used these words as synonyms, and what is bad is pain. Therefore, one state of affairs is better than another if it involves a greater balance of pleasure over pain, or a smaller balance of pain over pleasure. Of all possible states of affairs, that one is best which involves the greatest balance of pleasure over pain. There is nothing new in this doctrine, which came to be called utilitarianism. It had been advocated by Hutcheson as early as 1725. Bentham attributes it to Priestley, who, however, had no special claim to it. It is virtually contained in Locke. Bentham's merit consists not in the doctrine, but in his vigorous application of it to various practical problems. Bentham held not only that the good is happiness in general, but also that each individual always pursues what he believes to be his own happiness. The business of the legislator, therefore, is to produce harmony between public and private interests. It is to the interest of the public that I should abstain from theft, but it is only to my interest where there is an effective criminal law. Thus, the criminal law is a method of making the interests of the individual coincide with those of the community. That is its justification. Men are to be punished by the criminal law in order to prevent crime, not because we hate the criminal. It is more important that the punishment should be certain than that it should be severe. In his day in England, many quite minor offences were subject to the death penalty, with the result that juries often refused to convict because they thought the penalty excessive. Bentham advocated abolition of the death penalty for all but the worst offences, and before he died, the criminal law had been mitigated in this respect. Civil law, he says, should have four aims: subsistence, abundance, security, and equality. It will be observed that he does not mention liberty. In fact, he cared little for liberty. He admired the benevolent autocrats who preceded the French Revolution, Catherine the Great and the Emperor Francis. He had a great contempt for the doctrine of the rights of man. The rights of man, he said, are plain nonsense. The imprescriptible rights of man, nonsense on stilts. When the French revolutionaries made their Déclaration des droits de l'homme, Bentham called it a metaphysical work, the ne plus ultra of metaphysics. Its articles, he said, could be divided into three classes. 1, those that are unintelligible. 2, those that are false. 3, those that are both. Bentham's ideal, like that of Epicurus, was security, not liberty. Wars and storms are best to read of, but peace and calms are better to endure. His gradual evolution towards radicalism had two sources. On the one hand, a belief in equality, deduced from the calculus of pleasures and pains. On the other hand, an inflexible determination to submit everything to the arbitrament of reason as he understood it. His love of equality early led him to advocate equal division of a man's property among his children, and to oppose testamentary freedom. In later years, it led him to oppose monarchy and hereditary aristocracy, and to advocate complete democracy, including votes for women. His refusal to believe without rational grounds led him to reject religion, including belief in God. It made him keenly critical of absurdities and anomalies in the law, however venerable their historical origin. He would not excuse anything on the ground that it was traditional. From early youth he was opposed to imperialism, whether that of the British in America or that of other nations. He considered colonies a folly. It was through the influence of James Mill that Bentham was induced to take sides in practical politics. James Mill was 25 years younger than Bentham and an ardent disciple of his doctrines, but he was also an active radical. Bentham gave Mill a house, which had belonged to Milton, and assisted him financially while he wrote a history of India. When this history was finished, the East India Company gave James Mill a post, as they did afterwards to his son, until their abolition as a sequel to the mutiny. James Mill greatly admired Condorcet and Helvetius. Like all radicals of that period, he believed in the omnipotence of education. He practiced his theories on his son, John Stuart Mill, with results partly good, partly bad. The most important bad result was that John Stuart could never quite shake off his influence, even when he perceived that his father's outlook had been narrow. James Mill, like Bentham, considered pleasure the only good and pain the only evil. But like Epicurus, he valued moderate pleasure most. He thought intellectual enjoyments the best and temperance the chief virtue. The intense was with him a byword of scornful disapprobation, says his son, who adds that he objected to the modern stress laid upon feeling. Like the whole utilitarian school, he was utterly opposed to every form of romanticism. He thought politics could be governed by reason, and expected men's opinions to be determined by the weight of evidence. If opposing sides in a controversy are presented with equal skill, there is a moral certainty, so he held, that the greater number will judge right. His outlook was limited by the poverty of his emotional nature, but within his limitations he had the merits of industry, disinterestedness, and rationality. His son, John Stuart Mill, who was born in 1808, carried on a somewhat softened form of the Benthamite doctrine to the time of his death in 1873. Throughout the middle portion of the 19th century, the influence of the Benthamites on British legislation and policy was astonishingly great, considering their complete absence of emotional appeal. Bentham advanced various arguments in favour of the view that the general happiness is the summum bonum. Some of these arguments were acute criticisms of other ethical theories. In his treatise on political sophisms, he says, in language which seems to anticipate Marx, that sentimental and ascetic moralities serve the interests of the governing class and are the product of an aristocratic regime. Those who teach the morality of sacrifice, he continues, are not victims of error. They want others to sacrifice to them. The moral order, he says, results from equilibrium of interests. Governing corporations pretend that there is already identity of interests between the governors and the governed, but reformers make it clear that this identity does not yet exist and try to bring it about. He maintains that only the principle of utility can give a criterion in morals and legislation and lay the foundation of a social science. His main positive argument in favour of his principle is that it is really implied by apparently different ethical systems. This, however, is only made plausible by a severe restriction of his survey. There is an obvious lacuna in Bentham's system. If every man always pursues his own pleasure, how are we to secure that the legislator shall pursue the pleasure of mankind in general? Bentham's own instinctive benevolence, which his psychological theories prevented him from noticing, concealed the problem from him. If he had been employed to draw up a code of laws for some country, he would have framed his proposals in what he conceived to be the public interest, not so as to further his own interests or, consciously, the interests of his class. But if he had recognized this fact, he would have had to modify his psychological doctrines. He seems to have thought that, by means of democracy combined with adequate supervision, legislators could be so controlled that they could only further their private interests by being useful to the general public. There was in his day not much material for forming a judgment as to the working of democratic institutions, and his optimism was therefore perhaps excusable. But in our more disillusioned age, it seems somewhat naive. John Stuart Mill, in his Utilitarianism, offers an argument which is so fallacious that it is hard to understand how he can have thought it valid. He says, "Pleasure is the only thing desired. Therefore, pleasure is the only thing desirable." He argues that the only things visible are things seen, the only things audible are things heard, and similarly, the only things desirable are things desired. He does not notice that a thing is visible if it can be seen, but desirable if it ought to be desired. Thus, desirable is a word presupposing an ethical theory. We cannot infer what is desirable from what is desired. Again, if each man in fact and inevitably pursues his own pleasure, there is no point in saying he ought to do something else. Kant urged that you ought implies you can. Conversely, if you cannot, it is futile to say you ought. If each man must always pursue his own pleasure, ethics is reduced to prudence. You may do well to further the interests of others in the hope that they in turn will further yours. Similarly, in politics, all cooperation is a matter of log-rolling. From the premises of the utilitarians, no other conclusion is validly deducible. There are two distinct questions involved. First, does each man pursue his own happiness? Second, is the general happiness the right end of human action? When it is said that each man desires his own happiness, the statement is capable of two meanings, of which one is a truism and the other is false. Whatever I may happen to desire, I shall get some pleasure from achieving my wish. In this sense, whatever I desire is a pleasure, and it may be said, though somewhat loosely, that pleasures are what I desire. This is the sense of the doctrine, which is a truism. But if what is meant is that when I desire anything, I desire it because of the pleasure that it will give me, that is usually untrue. When I am hungry, I desire food, and so long as my hunger persists, food will give me pleasure. But the hunger, which is a desire, comes first. The pleasure is a consequence of the desire. I do not deny that there are occasions when there is a direct desire for pleasure. If you have decided to devote a free evening to the theatre, you will choose the theatre that you think will give you the most pleasure. But the actions thus determined by the direct desire for pleasure are exceptional and unimportant. Everybody's main activities are determined by desires which are anterior to the calculation of pleasures and pains. Anything whatever may be an object of desire. A masochist may desire his own pain. The masochist, no doubt, derives pleasure from the pain that he has desired, but the pleasure is because of the desire, not vice versa. A man may desire something that does not affect him personally, except because of his desire, for instance, the victory of one side in a war in which his country is neutral. He may desire an increase of general happiness or a mitigation of general suffering. Or he may, like Carlyle, desire the exact opposite. As his desires vary, so do his pleasures. Ethics is necessary because men's desires conflict. The primary cause of conflict is egoism. Most people are more interested in their own welfare than in that of other people. But conflicts are equally possible where there is no element of egoism. One man may wish everybody to be Catholic. Another may wish everybody to be Calvinist. Such non-egoistic desires are frequently involved in social conflicts. Ethics has a twofold purpose. First, to find a criterion by which to distinguish good and bad desires. Second, by means of praise and blame, to promote good desires and discourage such as are bad. The ethical part of the utilitarian doctrine, which is logically independent of the psychological part, says, those desires and those actions are good which in fact promote the general happiness. This need not be the intention of an action, but only its effect. Is there any valid theoretical argument either for or against this doctrine? We found ourselves faced with a similar question in relation to Nietzsche. His ethic differs from that of utilitarians, since it holds that only a minority of the human race have ethical importance. The happiness or unhappiness of the remainder should be ignored. I do not myself believe that this disagreement can be dealt with by theoretical arguments such as might be used in a scientific question. Obviously, those who are excluded from the Nietzschean aristocracy will object, and thus the issue becomes political rather than theoretical. The utilitarian ethic is democratic and anti-romantic. Democrats are likely to accept it, but those who like a more Byronic view of the world can, in my opinion, be refuted only practically, not by considerations which appeal only to facts as opposed to desires. The philosophical radicals were a transitional school. Their system gave birth to two others of more importance than itself, namely Darwinism and socialism. Darwinism was an application to the whole of animal and vegetable life of Malthus's theory of population, which was an integral part of the politics and economics of the Benthamites. A global free competition in which victory went to the animals that most resembled successful capitalists. Darwin himself was influenced by Malthus and was in general sympathy with the philosophical radicals. There was, however, a great difference between the competition admired by orthodox economists and the struggle for existence which Darwin proclaimed as the motive force of evolution. Free competition, in orthodox economics, is a very artificial conception, hedged in by legal restrictions. You may undersell a competitor, but you must not murder him. You must not use the armed forces of the state to help you get the better of foreign manufacturers. Those who have not the good fortune to possess capital must not seek to improve their lot by revolution. Free competition, as understood by the Benthamites, was by no means really free. Darwinian competition was not of this limited sort. There were no rules against hitting below the belt. The framework of law does not exist among animals. nor is war excluded as a competitive method. The use of the state to secure victory in competition was against the rules as conceived by the Benthamites, but could not be excluded from the Darwinian struggle. In fact, though Darwin himself was a liberal, and though Nietzsche never mentions him except with contempt, Darwin's survival of the fittest led, when thoroughly assimilated, to something much more like Nietzsche's philosophy than like Bentham's. These developments, however, belong to a later period, since Darwin's Origin of Species was published in 1859, and its political implications were not at first perceived. Socialism, on the contrary, began in the heyday of Benthamism, and as a direct outcome of orthodox economics. Ricardo, who was intimately associated with Bentham, Malthus, and James Mill, taught that the exchange value of a commodity is entirely due to the labor expended in producing it. He published this theory in 1817, and 8 years later, Thomas Hodgkin, an ex-naval officer, published the first socialist rejoinder, Labor Defended Against the Claims of Capital. He argued that if, as Ricardo taught, all value is conferred by labor, then all the reward ought to go to labor. The share at present obtained by the landowner and the capitalist must be mere extortion. Meanwhile, Robert Owen, after much practical experience as a manufacturer, had become convinced of the doctrine which soon came to be called socialism. The first use of the word socialist occurs in 1827, when it is applied to the followers of Owen. Machinery, he said, was displacing labor, and laissez-faire gave the working classes no adequate means of combating mechanical power. The method which he proposed for dealing with the evil was the earliest form of modern socialism. Although Owen was a friend of Bentham, who had invested a considerable sum of money in Owen's business, the philosophical radicals did not like his new doctrines. In fact, the advent of socialism made them less radical and less philosophical than they had been. Hodgkin secured a certain following in London, and James Mill was horrified. He wrote, "Their notions of property look ugly. They seem to think that it should not exist, and that the existence of it is an evil to them. Rascals, I have no doubt, are at work among them. The fools not to see that what they madly desire would be such a calamity to them as no hands but their own could bring upon them." This letter, written in 1831, may be taken as the beginning of the long war between capitalism and socialism. In a later letter, James Mill attributes the doctrine to the mad nonsense of Hodgkin and adds, "These opinions, if they were to spread, would be the subversion of civilized society, worse than the overwhelming deluge of Huns and Tartars." Socialism, in so far as it is only political or economic, does not come within the purview of a history of philosophy.
But in the hands of Karl Marx, socialism acquired a philosophy. His philosophy will be considered in the next chapter.
Chapter 27. Karl Marx. Karl Marx is usually thought of as the man who claimed to have made socialism scientific, and who did more than anyone else to create the powerful movement which, by attraction and repulsion, has dominated the recent history of Europe. It does not come within the scope of the present work to consider his economics, or his politics, except in certain general aspects. It is only as a philosopher, and as an influence on the philosophy of others, that I propose to deal with him. In this respect, he is difficult to classify. In one aspect, he is an outcome, like Hodgkin, of the philosophical radicals, continuing their rationalism and their opposition to the Romantics. In another aspect, he is a revivifier of materialism, giving it a new interpretation and a new connection with human history. In yet another aspect, he is the last of the great system builders, the successor of Hegel, a believer, like him, in a rational formula summing up the evolution of mankind. Emphasis upon any one of these aspects at the expense of the others gives a false and distorted view of his philosophy. The events of his life in part account for this complexity. He was born in 1818 at Trèves, like St. Ambrose. Trèves had been profoundly influenced by the French during the Revolutionary and Napoleonic era, and was much more cosmopolitan in outlook than most parts of Germany. His ancestors had been rabbis, but his parents became Christian when he was a child. He married a Gentile aristocrat, to whom he remained devoted throughout his life. At the university, he was influenced by the still prevalent Hegelianism, as also by Feuerbach's revolt against Hegel towards materialism.
He tried journalism, but the Rheinische Zeitung, which he edited, was suppressed by the authorities for its radicalism.
After this, in 1843, he went to France to study socialism. There he met Engels, who was the manager of a factory in Manchester. Through him, he came to know English labour conditions and English economics. He thus acquired, before the revolutions of 1848, an unusually international culture. So far as Western Europe was concerned, he showed no national bias. This cannot be said of Eastern Europe, for he always despised the Slavs. He took part in both the French and the German revolutions of 1848, but the reaction compelled him to seek refuge in England in 1849. He spent the rest of his life, with a few brief intervals, in London, troubled by poverty, illness, and the deaths of children, but nevertheless indefatigably writing and amassing knowledge. The stimulus to his work was always the hope of the social revolution, if not in his lifetime, then in some not very distant future. Marx, like Bentham and James Mill, will have nothing to do with Romanticism. It is always his intention to be scientific. His economics is an outcome of British classical economics, changing only the motive force. Classical economics, consciously or unconsciously, aimed at the welfare of the capitalists, as opposed both to the landowner and to the wage earner. Marx, on the contrary, set to work to represent the interest of the wage earner. He had in youth, as appears in the Communist Manifesto of 1848, the fire and passion appropriate to a new revolutionary movement, as liberalism had had in the time of Milton. But he was always anxious to appeal to evidence and never relied upon any extra scientific intuition. He called himself a materialist, but not of the 18th century sort. His sort, which under Hegelian influence he called dialectical, differed in an important way from traditional materialism, and was more akin to what is now called instrumentalism. The older materialism, he said, mistakenly regarded sensation as passive, and thus attributed activity primarily to the object. In Marx's view, all sensation or perception is an interaction between subject and object. The bare object, apart from the activity of the percipient, is a mere raw material which is transformed in the process of becoming known. Knowledge, in the old sense of passive contemplation, is an unreal abstraction. The process that really takes place is one of handling things. The question whether objective truth belongs to human thinking is not a question of theory, but a practical question, he says. The truth, that is, the reality and power of thought, must be demonstrated in practice. The contest as to the reality or non-reality of a thought, which is isolated from practice, is a purely scholastic question. Philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways, but the real task is to alter it. I think we may interpret Marx's meaning that the process which philosophers have called the pursuit of knowledge is not, as has been thought, one in which the object is constant while all the adaptation is on the part of the knower. On the contrary, both subject and object, both the knower and the thing known, are in a continual process of mutual adaptation. He calls the process dialectical because it is never fully completed. It is essential to this theory to deny the reality of sensation as conceived by British empiricists. What happens when it is most nearly what they mean by sensation would be better called noticing, which implies activity. In fact, so Marx would contend, we only notice things as part of the process of acting with reference to them, and any theory which leaves out action is a misleading abstraction. So far as I know, Marx was the first philosopher who criticized the notion of truth from this activist point of view. In him, this criticism was not much emphasized, and I shall therefore say no more about it here, leaving the examination of the theory to a later chapter. Marx's philosophy of history is a blend of Hegel and British economics. Like Hegel, he thinks that the world develops according to a dialectical formula, but he totally disagrees with Hegel as to the motive force of this development. Hegel believed in a mystical entity called spirit, which causes human history to develop according to the stages of the dialectic as set forth in Hegel's logic. Why spirit has to go through these stages is not clear. One is tempted to suppose that spirit is trying to understand Hegel, and at each stage rashly objectifies what it has been reading. Marx's dialectic has none of this quality except a certain inevitableness. For Marx, matter, not spirit, is the driving force. But it is matter in the peculiar sense that we have been considering, not the wholly dehumanized matter of the atomists. This means that, for Marx, the driving force is really man's relation to matter, of which the most important part is his mode of production. In this way, Marx's materialism, in practice, becomes economics. The politics, religion, philosophy, and art of any epoch in human history are, according to Marx, an outcome of its methods of production, and, to a lesser extent, of distribution. I think he would not maintain that this applies to all the niceties of culture, but only to its broad outlines. The doctrine is called the materialist conception of history. This is a very important thesis. In particular, it concerns the historian of philosophy. I do not myself accept the thesis as it stands, but I think that it contains very important elements of truth, and I am aware that it has influenced my own views of philosophical development, as set forth in the present work. Let us, to begin with, consider the history of philosophy in relation to Marx's doctrine. Subjectively, every philosopher appears to himself to be engaged in the pursuit of something which may be called truth. Philosophers may differ as to the definition of truth, but at any rate it is something objective, something which in some sense everybody ought to accept. No man would engage in the pursuit of philosophy if he thought that all philosophy is merely an expression of irrational bias. But every philosopher will agree that many other philosophers have been actuated by bias and have had extra-rational reasons of which they were usually unconscious for many of their opinions. Marx, like the rest, believes in the truth of his own doctrines. He does not regard them as nothing but an expression of the feelings natural to a rebellious middle-class German Jew in the middle of the 19th century. What can be said about this conflict between the subjective and objective views of a philosophy? We may say in a broad way that Greek philosophy, down to Aristotle, expresses the mentality appropriate to the city-state, that Stoicism is appropriate to a cosmopolitan despotism, that scholastic philosophy is an intellectual expression of the church as an organization, that philosophy since Descartes, or at any rate since Locke, tends to embody the prejudices of the commercial middle class, and that Marxism and fascism are philosophies appropriate to the modern industrial state. This, I think, is both true and important. I think, however, that Marx is wrong in two respects. First, the social circumstances, of which account must be taken, are quite as much political as economic. They have to do with power, of which wealth is only one form. Second, social causation largely ceases to apply as soon as a problem becomes detailed and technical. The first of these objections I have set forth in my book, Power, and I shall therefore say no more about it. The second more intimately concerns the history of philosophy, and I will give some examples of its scope. Take first the problem of universals. This problem was first discussed by Plato, then by Aristotle, by the schoolmen, by the British empiricists, and by the most modern logicians. It would be absurd to deny that bias has influenced the opinions of philosophers on this question. Plato was influenced by Parmenides and Orphism. He wanted an eternal world and could not believe in the ultimate reality of the temporal flux. Aristotle was more empirical and had no dislike of the everyday world. Thoroughgoing empiricists in modern times have a bias which is the opposite of Plato's. They find the thought of a supersensible world unpleasant and are willing to go to great lengths to avoid having to believe in it. But these opposing kinds of bias are perennial and have only a somewhat remote connection with the social system. It is said that the love of the eternal is characteristic of a leisure class, which lives on the labor of others. I doubt if this is true. Epictetus and Spinoza were not gentlemen of leisure. It might be urged, on the contrary, that the conception of heaven as a place where nothing is done is that of weary toilers who want nothing but rest. Such argumentation can be carried on indefinitely and leads nowhere. On the other hand, when we come to the detail of the controversy about universals, we find that each side can invent arguments which the other side will admit to be valid. Some of Aristotle's criticisms of Plato on this question have almost been universally accepted. In quite recent times, although no decision has been reached, a new technique has been developed and many incidental problems have been solved. It is not irrational to hope that before very long, a definitive agreement may be reached by logicians on this question. Take as a second example the ontological argument. This, as we have seen, was invented by Anselm, rejected by Thomas Aquinas, accepted by Descartes, refuted by Kant, and reinstated by Hegel. I think it may be said quite decisively that, as a result of analysis of the concept existence, modern logic has proved this argument invalid. This is not a matter of temperament or of the social system. It is a purely technical matter. The refutation of the argument affords, of course, no ground for supposing its conclusion, namely, the existence of God, to be untrue. If it did, we cannot suppose that Thomas Aquinas would have rejected the argument. Or take the question of materialism. This is a word which is capable of many meanings. We have seen that Marx radically altered its significance. The heated controversies as to its truth or falsehood have largely depended, for their continued vitality, upon avoidance of definition. When the term is defined, it will be found that, according to some possible definitions, materialism is demonstrably false. According to certain others, it may be true, though there is no positive reason to think so. While, according to yet other definitions, there are some reasons in its favour, though these reasons are not conclusive. All this, again, depends upon technical considerations and has nothing to do with the social system. The truth of the matter is really fairly simple. What is conventionally called philosophy consists of two very different elements. On the one hand, there are questions which are scientific or logical. These are amenable to methods as to which there is general agreement. On the other hand, there are questions of passionate interest to large numbers of people, as to which there is no solid evidence either way. Among the latter are practical questions, as to which it is impossible to remain aloof. When there is a war, I must support my own country or come into painful conflict both with friends and with the authorities. At many times there has been no middle course between supporting and opposing the official religion. For one reason or another, we all find it impossible to maintain an attitude of sceptical detachment on many issues as to which pure reason is silent. A philosophy, in a very usual sense of the word, is an organic whole of such extra-rational decisions. It is in regard to philosophy in this sense that Marx's contention is largely true. But even in this sense, a philosophy is determined by other social causes as well as by those that are economic. War especially has its share in historical causation, and victory in war does not always go to the side with the greatest economic resources. Marx fitted his philosophy of history into a mould suggested by Hegelian dialectic. But in fact, there was only one triad that concerned him. Feudalism, represented by the landowner, capitalism, represented by the industrial employer, and socialism, represented by the wage earner. Hegel thought of nations as the vehicles of dialectic movement. Marx substituted classes. He disclaimed always all ethical or humanitarian reasons for preferring socialism or taking the side of the wage earner. He maintained not that this side was ethically better, but that it was the side taken by the dialectic in its wholly deterministic movement. He might have said that he did not advocate socialism, but only prophesied it. This, however, would not have been wholly true. He undoubtedly believed every dialectical movement to be, in some impersonal sense, a progress. And he certainly held that socialism, once established, would minister to human happiness more than either feudalism or capitalism have done. These beliefs, though they must have controlled his life, remained largely in the background so far as his writings are concerned. Occasionally, however, he abandons calm prophecy for vigorous exhortation to rebellion, and the emotional basis of his ostensibly scientific prognostications is implicit in all he wrote. Considered purely as a philosopher, Marx has grave shortcomings. He is too practical, too much wrapped up in the problems of his time. His purview is confined to this planet, and within this planet to man. Since Copernicus, it has been evident that man has not the cosmic importance which he formerly arrogated to himself. No man who has failed to assimilate this fact has a right to call his philosophy scientific. There goes with this limitation to terrestrial affairs a readiness to believe in progress as a universal law. This readiness characterized the 19th century and existed in Marx as much as in his contemporaries. It is only because of the belief in the inevitability of progress that Marx thought it possible to dispense with ethical considerations. If socialism was coming, it must be an improvement. He would have readily admitted that it would not seem to be an improvement to landowners or capitalists, but that only showed that they were out of harmony with the dialectical movement of the time. Marx professed himself an atheist, but retained a cosmic optimism which only theism could justify. Broadly speaking, all the elements in Marx's philosophy which are derived from Hegel are unscientific, in the sense that there is no reason whatever to suppose them true. Perhaps the philosophic dress that Marx gave to his socialism had really not much to do with the basis of his opinions. It is easy to restate the most important part of what he had to say without any reference to the dialectic. He was impressed by the appalling cruelty of the industrial system as it existed in England 100 years ago, which he came to know thoroughly through Engels and the reports of royal commissions. He saw that the system was likely to develop from free competition towards monopoly, and that its injustice must produce a movement of revolt in the proletariat. He held that, in a thoroughly industrialized community, the only alternative to private capitalism is state ownership of land and capital. None of these propositions are matters for philosophy, and I shall therefore not consider their truth or falsehood. The point is that, if true, they suffice to establish what is practically important in his system. The Hegelian trappings might therefore be dropped with advantage. The history of Marx's reputation has been peculiar. In his own country, his doctrines inspired the program of the Social Democratic Party, which grew steadily until, in the general election of 1912, it secured one-third of all the votes cast. Immediately after the First World War, the Social Democratic Party was for a time in power, and Ebert, the first president of the Weimar Republic, was a member of it. But by this time, the party had ceased to adhere to Marxist orthodoxy. Meanwhile, in Russia, fanatical believers in Marx had acquired the government. In the West, no large working-class movement has been Marxist.